Hello and welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 9, The Limey from 1999. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And this is one of the first movies that we've done, I think, that I'd seen before. Most of what he'd done, I guess Sex Lies and Out of Sight, I'd seen before, but this is sort of familiar territory for me. So this is an unusual experience so far here in Cinemakers for me.
I've seen this movie a couple times. First saw it about around the time I saw Schizopolis. I guess around the time I met Tobin where he turned me on to Schizopolis, and then I went back and tried to fill in the gaps of all the Soderbergh I hadn't seen. And this was one that I discovered way back then. And I'd seen it, I visited a couple times because I really liked this movie. So I was really glad to rewatch it.
Yeah, this came out senior year of college. This is one that sort of nobody in my circle saw in the theater, but we all passed around the DVD of, like, almost like a, you know, like a secret. Like, here, you've got to see this, got to see this movie. This will blow your mind. And this may be one of the Soderberghs I've seen the most. I teach it often, pieces of it or occasionally the whole thing in classes, as many classes as I can fit it into. But I know this movie pretty well.
It's kind of, in certain ways, like peak Soderbergh in terms of the things that he's done that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks and things he's going to go on to do. I mean, we keep talking a lot about his nonlinear editing and about how that sort of started with King of the Hill in that one scene and then jumped around and Out of Sight. We saw it a lot last week. But here, I mean, this whole movie, I mean, even when you know what's going on, it's sometimes hard to figure out what's the past, what's the present, what's the future, what's just thought, what's just a dream, like what's a memory. Like, there's all sorts of timelines going on here, and they're all weaved together to tell this one story, like a simple story. Basically, this guy flies to LA to figure out what happened to his daughter who was killed, and then maybe get revenge. And like, it's a simple story, but the way that they weave together, I don't know, like 6 or 7 probably different timelines, like there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I think it helps that it's not a very complex plot, right? I mean, it's very simple, like you said. Like, his daughter's dead and he wants to go find out what happens. And I think because it's so small, he's able to do all those things with the editing. You know, it feels like it's being told in order, even though you're aware it's not. Like, you're not even, I wasn't even aware this time again, having seen it a few times, until the very end, the time in which certain events took place. But you definitely see things early on in the film that took place later in the timeline. So even though it is playing tricks on you, I never felt confused or sort of like out of my depth. I always had a comfort in knowing that somewhere toward the end, this puzzle was going to form a complete picture.
Yeah, it's surprisingly clear for as nonlinear as the storytelling style is. And you're totally right, Joey. It all comes down to how simple the premise is, how the plot itself, the, you know, 15 or 24 events that happen in the movie are easy to follow. They're moving relatively linearly, and sort of all the scenes around it shift back and forth. And sometimes there are these extraordinary scenes that we'll get to where you'll see a scene take place or a conversation will take place in order in a linear fashion, but the film jumps back and forth between 3 or 4 different locations shooting the conversation in order. It's just this kind of fascinating ways of getting at memory and as well as film, you know, if the idea is that he is, that we learned from that making of on the King of the Hill disc, that he's trying to break from the shackles of narrative. And he really does this here, partly because he has such a fixed and simple story to tell.
One thing he does here, though, that I don't think we've seen yet, and I don't know if we're going to see again. I'm guessing probably, I don't think he's ever going to do things that like work well that he's just going to abandon. But I don't know, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but you guys are more familiar with him than I am. He shows future realities that don't happen. Like when Terrence Stamp is at the party, and he goes and like they show him shooting guys and killing guys and, you know, all this different, like what he could do. And then none of that happens. But when you don't know that it's not happening until it flashes back to reality. And that's something new. And it's something along those same lines, right? That we've been seeing, but a little bit of a twist on it to give it a little bit more excitement, as opposed to if you just showed what happened, you'd just be watching a guy thinking, like just staring at a guy for a while and then leaving.
Yeah, I think it's like an evolution of the nonlinear style in a way where it it's taken into daydream land, or, you know, brings you deeper inside the psyche of the main character, right? Like, this is what he's thinking. He wants to shoot this man. He wants to stab this man. Like, he's just in front of all these people, but, you know, he can't. It's just not proper etiquette, I suppose, to just shoot someone in front of everybody like that. But no, like, it's just not the time. The timing isn't right. But yeah, I think that's something you see in other films as well. But it works especially well in this, and it tricks you because of he's already set up that film language where he's jumping around in time and you're inside this guy's head and, you know, you're not sure, are we seeing clear memories or not? Are these things that actually happened, or is he just, like, you know, imagining the worst? So I felt like that was working.
Yeah, you realize from very early in this film that he could cut anywhere. You know, he could go from a shot of Terrence Stamp sitting alone in his hotel room staring at the wall to a shot of Terrence Stamp 30 years ago with his then wife to Terrence Stamp, you know, 5 minutes later bashing some guy's head in with the butt of a revolver. Like, you never know. And you never know in those things, is it or not? You never know. But he could take you into a memory. He could take you into a flashback. He could take you into a flash forward. So when it gets to this party scene, which is one of the scenes that I show all the time, he's at Peter Fonda's house and he thinks that Peter Fonda is responsible for the death of his daughter. And we see him staring at him, you know, from this balcony. And then he walks in and shoots him in the chest, right? And then it cuts back to him on the balcony and he's watching and hasn't done anything. Then he goes in again and this time shoots him in the head. And then comes back out again, hasn't done it. And he plays that trick three times. And by the third time, you think, oh, this is the real one. He's actually going to kill him now. And then when he doesn't, you know, when he gets stopped by Luis Guzman, there's a sense for me anyway of sort of delight and wonder at what he's been able to accomplish. And like, now I really know he could do anything in this movie, because now I can't for sure even believe what I'm seeing that looks like it's taking place in the present.
No, absolutely. You sort of have to really be on your toes here when you're watching, because you don't know, like you said, like, you don't know where he's cutting from, where he's cutting to. Like, you know why. Like, there's a reason to it, but you don't know what's coming next. And it requires not necessarily active viewing, but you can't sort of check out, because you'd be like, well, how did we get here? And then all of a sudden we're back to a different place. And like, you really have to be paying attention to the entire, I guess, montage style, right? Like, that's sort of like the montage style editing, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. This is this editing style that he's got going here turns out to be all motivated by the fact that you learn at the end of the movie that these the shots of him on the plane that we keep getting, the movie begins him walking out of an airport and you know, getting in a car and heading off on his adventure in LA, and you keep cutting back to him sitting on a plane, just not quite randomly. Like, it feels like it's for a purpose, but I'm never quite sure when I'm going to go back there. And you realize by the end of the movie, that's him on the plane flying back to London, or at least that's what you think it is. And which means that the whole movie is sort of playing in his head over the, like, he's remembering his week in LA and what he did there and how he felt about it and the closure he's come to and all the characters he met along the way, which sort of is a psychological, you know, reason to be able to montage the whole movie, to be able to have all this, you know, we'll call it discontinuity editing, where the cuts are not seamless, the cuts stand out. You really notice the editing in this movie. The way I like to describe it when I'm teaching my undergraduate students is that if my mom would notice the editing, then it's definitely discontinuity editing. And my mom would notice something's going on with the editing in this movie. And I think that, to my mind, the real power of this movie, because I think if this played, I don't know what you guys feel like, I think if this played in a linear fashion, it would be pretty dull, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's part of the power is the way that the story is told. You know, this you don't realize until the end of the film that the storytelling device is this wraparound of him on the airplane, but you're not sure until the end whether he's coming or going. Right. There's a real sort of like Memento-esque thing going on with it that works, and that if you told it straight, I don't think you would have the same impact, or you would get the same value out of the story, because they would be more familiar. Like, this, for instance, isn't very much more than Death Wish, right? Like, if you think about it, he's Charles Bronson going after the guy who raped and murdered his daughter. Although, you know, she didn't get raped, but like, she did get murdered. So it's what elevates it from just being another version of Death Wish, Death Wish 6, 7, or 8. And I love those movies, but I don't need to see another one. They don't need to remake that. And if you are going to remake it, you do it like this. You know, you take it to this type of level. You mask it as like a mainstream art film almost. And you play with the audience's mind because they're so familiar with this idea of, you know, a father going after justice for his daughter. So I think there's just a lot of elements that lined up well in order to play with narrative with this particular story.
This is a movie that gets deeper inside a character's head than maybe anyone I've seen. It's and not just how he feels, although you do get a sense of how Terrence Stamp feels, but this guy can hold a close-up, you know, like these close-ups of him on the plane or in the hotel room or in the car or wherever, just sort of looking out the window and thinking sounds kind of dull. And maybe it would be to some people. I find it fascinating, and it involves me so much in his thought process. It's something Soderbergh talked about somewhere along the way with regard to this movie, is that he thought one thing movies could do really well is show people thinking. And then you either show them what they were, you know, either show the audience what they were thinking or just what influenced that thought or whatever. And that the cutting of movies can mirror the way our minds work, you know, the way our memories work or our dreams or even just our thoughts that, you know, move by association, not through time, right? So you sit here and you say something that reminds me of a friend I knew 10 years ago who loved this movie, and that reminds me of the director who did the, like, your mind goes in these sort of chains of association, and that's what he wants, I think, the cutting to do in this movie, which gets you so deeply into Terrence Stamp's head, into his character's thinking, that it sort of gets me, even without, there's no voiceover, there's nothing where he sort of lays out very much of, you know, what he's thinking or feeling, but you get it from the way that the movie's put together.
And I think part of the reason that works so well is because this is another movie that Lem Dobbs wrote. So this is not the first time that we've seen him in Soderbergh's career. And so I think they probably collaborated in a way that Soderbergh is able to visualize what the writing is like, and that they're able to write in a way that he can then put on screen and tell this story and tell these inner emotions and do it in a way that's interesting, like visually and narratively. Now, in terms of holding a close-up, did you guys know that, I don't know if it would have worked, maybe I'm just too biased to what he's done lately, but when the script was originally written, they were picturing Michael Caine in this role?
Huh.
I would have thought, I could have seen maybe Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
But Michael Caine, didn't he eventually do Harry Brown? So he got around to doing a role similar to this. For me, what worked so well was that it was Terrence Stamp, because I most associate him with the ultimate badass, which is General Zod, right? Like, I grew up kind of fearing this guy on screen, and I don't know a whole lot of his work. I actually did go back a while and get that movie that they show clips of him as a young guy, Poor Cow, it's called. But he's not really in that movie. So that's kind of like all he's in. It's more about the girl. She's a single mother in like the 60s or 70s in London, like living in squalor and stuff. But anyway, back to Zod. Like, I mean, I just feel like he brings, like, you put him on screen, I don't care if he's, you know, 50 or 80, like, he's a badass. Like, he's scary. He's a scary dude. And until he kind of opens himself up a little to, like, Luis Guzman and the acting teacher and these people, like, then you realize, okay, like, there's a soft side. Like, there's a more, like, benevolent side to this guy, which might even make him more dangerous, because you know that he cares about things and that, you know, he cares about losing things, especially stuff like his daughter. And he's got sort of a sordid past with her, too. So he really needs to make that right. But I just feel like the casting was spot on here.
And there's no more sympathetic moment than at the very end, that the entire time, the entire reason he went to Los Angeles was to get vengeance for his daughter. And he's on the beach with Peter Fonda, and he's able to kill the guy who, for all intents and purposes, maybe not murdered his daughter, but, you know, led to her death, and he lets him live. Like, there's no bigger show of sympathy or, you know, soft side or inside, like, understanding how this guy thinks than by realizing that, you know, they sort of have a shared experience of his daughter, you know, threatening to call someone on the phone, threatening to call the cops, and then not doing it. And so that, like, the scenes that you mentioned, Mike, about, you know, opening up to Luis Guzman and everybody, building up to that end shows you where this comes from, right?
Right. And also, the way I read that ending is that he's realizing his own culpability in his daughter's death, that she has played out the same role with Terry Valentine, except, of course, you know, she was sleeping with him too, but that she played the same role of, like, getting herself involved with this guy who was up to no good, and then calling the authorities because she wanted him to be better, and that leading to her doom, that he sort of set her up for all this. And I think that if it's not sympathy for Terry, it's an understanding that he's not much better than Terry vis-a-vis his daughter and how she, like, what he's done to her, and that, that he comes to his peace with his own sort of, like, his redemption comes through recognizing that he's at fault here too.
After leaving a trail of bodies behind him, too.
Yes, he kills a lot of people.
Which is,
true.
Like, he still gets to satiate that bloodlust.
And I love that he buys the gun from the kids, that Luis Guzman sets him up with these, like, middle schoolers or high schoolers to buy his weaponry. I think that's it just a, and that's a scene where they don't talk, you know, like, it's a silent scene, and it's not, they don't make a big deal out of it, but it is a pretty, you know, clear comment on, you know, gun culture in 1999.
Guzman is great. It was great to see him here in, like, a really big sort of expanded role, because
you get back from out of sight.
Yeah, and you just generally don't really get dudes that are like him in sort of, like, supporting leading roles, I feel. It just seems like more of a character actor type, but he pops on screen, and I really like him. And, you know, we haven't really talked about the use of language in this movie, which I feel is, like, another one of Soderbergh's big sort of themes, you know, like, going back to, like, Schizopolis and things, and saying what we're not saying in Sex Lies and, like, coded talk or whatever. But in this, you know, he's talking that Cockney slang the whole movie. And sometimes it's just great to hear him and Luis Guzman having a conversation between the two of them, because you can't really get what they're saying, but you under, I think another character says it in the movie where it's like, did you understand what he said? It's like, no, but I know what he means, you know, there's something to that effect. And I really picked up on that a lot in this movie. But that Cockney stuff was pretty cool.
Yeah, given where the movie ends, the, you know, the idea of what had been left unsaid between him and his daughter, you know, thematically, there's a lot there too. You're totally right. Not only in the their sort of mistranslation back and forth to one another, but the whole idea that he's that he didn't say things he should have, and maybe his daughter said things that she shouldn't have, and, you know, it's all wrapped up in that whole sort of fascination he has with language and with and the limits of language, right?
I do want to go back a little bit and sort of re-mention a point that Mike just sort of, not glossed over, but mentioned and sort of moved on from. But another thing that is really interesting, I think, about this movie is the clips from Poor Cow that I was like, how did they get him looking so young? And then I realized it was just from a different movie. And in terms of the behind-the-scenes thing, apparently Soderbergh wanted Warner Brothers to license, give him the rights to the entire film. And they were like, nah, you can't do that. You need to pick your scenes. And he's just like, well, then I'm just never going to make a movie for you guys again. And they eventually gave in. But, like, they had finished shooting before they figured out, like, before they got the license to that film. So he said, like, it was terrifying that... that he didn't know if they were going to have anything, or if they weren't going to have the right scenes, or, you know, whatever. And then eventually Warner was like, all right, you can have everything. And they only use it probably maybe, what, like 30 seconds or maybe a minute of footage at most. But, like, it works so perfectly.
And and he's not really in a whole lot of that movie. Like, those are the scenes I feel like he's in of that film. It's still a good movie, though. Like, it's about a single mother whose boyfriend was a crook, and if memory serves, Terrence Stamp is part of the gang, and they end up together once the guy goes to prison, but then he ends up going to prison and she's raising this kid alone, pretty much, like, in the streets. But to my recollection, the footage of their daughter is new footage. That isn't the kid from the original movie. So I guess if all else had failed, if they didn't get the footage they needed, they could have reenacted the footage of the mother at least and sort of shot the young Terrence Stamp from behind, or tried to have recast it or do some kind of, you know, digital wizardry. But that is kind of, that is some good thinking there. Like, you know, let's go back into some archives and see if we could find old footage of our actor that will play into this film. You know, nowadays you see it a lot, like even in the new Pirates movie, they have, like, retouched Johnny Depp with digital makeup to make him look like a 19-year-old sailing the ship or something. You know, they do it with, they do it like crazy in the Marvel movies too. So it's kind of funny, like, he's a little, like, ahead of his time in that regard.
Yeah, it's also a callback as much of this movie is to the, you know, an earlier era. You know, we've got stars here who all made their big breaks in the 60s. He's drawing heavily on a movie called Point Blank in terms of the editing style, a Lee Marvin movie, right? That has a similar kind of back and forth, nonlinear but aggressive editing style, violent editing style. And of course, the soundtrack. We haven't mentioned the soundtrack. This is one of my favorite in terms of, like, you know, not just the score, but the songs he's using, the pop songs he's using. You know, he's really sort of bathing this movie in 60s nostalgia, and I think it just lends a whole new flavor to this movie.
Is this the first time to date, or maybe just the most prominent example of him licensing pop songs?
It has to be.
Because I can't remember too many others, because we keep talking about the scores, and Cliff Martinez is back here for probably the fourth or fifth movie, and there was another guy, I think, who maybe did two of his movies already. But I can't think of any other movies that really, like, I mean, this movie, the first thing you either, like, see or hear, like, the first thing you experience in this movie is The Who's The Seeker, which is so thematically, you know, on the nose, but it also is perfect. That's, like, and I think he's talked about, like, how that's, like, the song that, you know, it, like, Terrence Stamp's brother or somebody was, like, their manager? I don't know. Something, some weird behind-the-scenes relationship there, too, but, like, it works for the character, it works perfectly for the movie, it gives you the energy of the movie, but I don't think he's done any kind of, like, licensing songs we know up to this point, and it's kind of shocking that he hasn't, because it works so perfectly here.
Well, he's not going to put anything in Kafka, right? I mean, he's been limited in the sorts of movies he could use, and I think that this sort of, you know, as you say, is kind of a culmination in a lot of ways, a peak Soderbergh, I think you said, which is really true. Like, he's playing with all of these things it's not that he's playing with them, he's played with them before, but he really feels freed from having to sort of do things one way, and he's feeling like he has command, not just of the sort of visual language of cinema, but being able to sort of throw caution to the wind and sort of go, you know, follow his instincts, which are turning out to be quite good. And I think that the pop songs are just one example of that.
Yeah, it feels like an evolution, you know, like maybe he's just ready to introduce other people's music into his works. You know, I could understand being a little like, well, like, it's a movie, let's create everything from the ground up, including, like, new music, you know, a score. You know, movies have scores and stuff, so, like, maybe you just kind of stick to that for a couple films, and it's time to just move on or break out of that and expand yourself a little bit. And he's just got really good instincts when it comes to music. I mean, already, I don't think I've ever had, you know, even if I wasn't really down with the film, I don't recall ever not liking any of the music that's accompanied a lot of his stuff. So it's just, I feel like it's the start of a streak of him picking pop songs that is going to continue. It's just, he's got a really good ear.
Well, I know, like, in a couple movies, like, I'm trying to think, man, I just don't know his filmography that well, but I know in a couple movies when we get to Oceans, I know that there's the Paul Oakenfold remix of an Elvis song, which is great, and that works so perfectly in that movie. I think it's just, like, it's almost better when it's reserved. Like, it's just a few times, a few songs, and it's spot on.
He uses it when he needs it, like all these tools. You know, there's a version of this movie that would use these things in excess. And I know some people who feel like the editing style is over the top, that he is doing too much with it. But to my mind, he's not. I think because, as we've said, the story of the movie is so clear, and we're so much in his head. But you're totally right. If he's gonna lard up traffic with a bunch of, you know, pop songs, but it's better to save it for, you know, Magic Mike. I mean, you're gonna need some pop songs when you get to that, right? And I don't remember much about Haywire, but there's possibility in movies like that, also written by Lem Dobbs, that you're gonna have options there too. He really seems to be. You know, the thing he said earlier in the interview before one of the previous movies, that if he likes to, you know, make one big aesthetic decision at the beginning that sort of sets the course for the rest of the movie. And it feels like it just means that then when he's making choices during the making of the movie, he's making choices about that movie at that moment. He's not necessarily thinking about before or after, right? Like, he's, what's right for this movie? Oh, the 60s rock and roll is right for this movie. And he's just so right.
Yeah, and it elevates the sort of the mystique of Peter Fonda, too. You know, it's like, oh, in case you don't remember, like, this guy's got history, and this will sort of, like, remind you and harken back. Like you said, like, there's there's a reason for it. It's, I mean, sometimes, especially nowadays, you know, they use music as a crutch a lot, especially pop songs. And like, not everyone can be a Tarantino when it comes to, you know, dropping a needle, unfortunately. So like, it's just nice to know that he's got that reserve and that he keeps it for a reason. And it's like a weapon, you know, you bring it out at the appropriate time to create like a maximum amount of effect, and I think it does that really well.
Yeah, what's kind of cool is that it's period music, but not to the period of the movie, right? Like, he's not using it to cue you to when the movie's taking place. He's using it to cue you to when the movie's, like, the vibe of the movie is, right? It's a similar thing to the way that Scorsese uses music in some of his gangster movies. You know, music that maybe wasn't even around at the time, you know, but just because it has to do with the feeling or the mood or there's something about the expression of the music emotionally or sort of psychologically that fits that moment so well. And that's what it feels like he's doing here.
If we could change courses for a little bit, because I was looking through my notes and I saw something else that I wanted to talk about. When he goes to that warehouse and he ostensibly kills everybody in the place except for the one guy, it's interesting to me that the violence is off-screen. That it's just implied. We don't know, you know, I guess in theory he could have just shot everybody in the leg and, you know, let that one guy go. I mean, probably not, but who knows? But I wonder, like, it's obviously intentional, and I don't know if that's budgeting or if that's to not show violence or to sort of keep it so that you can still root for the guy. You know what I mean? Like, as opposed to a modern day, you know, action movie, like, I saw this movie, I think, for the first time the same summer, around the same time I saw Taken, and it's like, it's similar stories, but so, so very different, because there you're like rooting for Liam Neeson to kill as many guys as possible to get his daughter back, right? And here, I wonder if not showing him kill guys, like, you know that he's there, but you can sort of rationalize, like, oh, well, no, he's still a good guy, because I haven't seen him kill anybody.
Yeah, I think that's partially it. The other thing is you do see him get his ass kicked, right? So, yeah, they're definitely tipping the scales of sympathy in his balance toward his side, because he goes in there and he's like, you know Jenny. And he's like, who the fuck is Jenny? Who the hell are you? Like, someone get this old guy out of here. And they end up kicking his ass and everything. And yeah, he just whips out a gun and the camera stays outside while he walks in and you hear the shots. Now, to me, I didn't need to see it. This is something like I noticed Soderbergh did with like Out of Sight. I think we mentioned this with when they're in the car. Glenn is in the car and they're getting ready to go do some job, and they're talking about doing this job, and they're pulling out like hacksaws, right, and hatchets and guns and all these things. And it's like, you know, it's the build up to the violence, and then you don't show the violence and you have to play it out in your head. And so to me, I saw him, you know, go in there, guns blazing, like shooting everybody but the guy who put his hands on him and let that guy go. And then when he comes out screaming, you know, telling him I'm fucking coming, I feel like I experienced the violence enough without even seeing it.
Yeah, he also is the sort of lead guy in the warehouse, like in the middle of them beating him up, whispers to him what he would have liked to have done to Jenny, what he'd like to have done to Terrence Stamp's daughter. We don't hear what he says. In the same way of we don't see the violence, but you can easily guess that it's some kind of terrible, horrific thing that he wanted to commit to the guy's daughter. So we totally are comfortable, as is the case with this sort of revenge movie. Like we don't feel any qualms about these guys getting killed in this movie. The movie does not expect us to anyway. And so part of it might be keeping him a good guy in our minds. The movie's not going to be afraid to show violence, right? The movie's not going to shy away from times when people are, you know, shot in this movie, or imagining that people are being shot, fantasizing about it. But there's something, what this moment mostly is about, and what I think Soderbergh is trying to convey with it, is the threat, the threat to Terry. That when he lets the one guy go and yells, you know, tell him I'm fucking coming, that's the most important moment. The close-up we get is just about as close as we ever get to Terrence Stamp in the movie. Like, it's really, really close to his face. And all the violence inside, even though we're outside, it's all one take. He's, you know, gets up from being beaten up, pulls out the gun, walks back inside, bang, 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 and then comes out and says his line. And also, if we're thinking about this movie as taking place through his memory of what's gone on, for him, the killing these guys is clearly no big deal, right? Like, the part he's going to remember is the venom he feels as he shouts after, you know, the threat to Terry, and that the violence he commits is not necessarily important to him, right? So that's the kind of guy he is.
I just want to know why anybody would talk to him in a way when he goes into a warehouse with a gun and is like beating up on people. Why would you treat him that way? Like that's only going to end poorly.
Yeah, true.
I like that, though, because those are tropes of these types of revenge films, right? Like, you're going to get these idiot thugs who don't know that this guy's dangerous at all, right? And so they're going to just, like, play him off like a joke and think that they've taken care of him and dust off their jackets, but they really should not let their guard down. You know, there's also a trope in these types of films where the good guy, you know, or the anti-hero comes in and blows everybody away. So they should watch more of these types of movies before acting that way towards people they don't know.
Yeah, this scene also brings out another of my confessions that I occasionally have on these podcasts, which I didn't even realize.
Man, they are coming fast and furious lately.
This is not a big one. But there's one of the thugs who seems to be a non-actor. I don't think those guys are trained actors, which worked well in the scene, I think. But one of these thugs calls Terrence Stamp fucko, which feels like an ad lib. And I've used that in scripts like half a dozen times in the last 10 years, having no thinking I had come up with it, or at least that I didn't know where it came from. And I'm now I know for sure it came from this movie, and I can never use it again because I know that what I'm doing when I say it is I'm referencing this movie. For whatever reason, that term stuck in my head and came out of my fingers, onto a lot of pages.
I love it. Can we talk about how Peter Fonda's girlfriend or whatever is basically Denise Richards?
Yes,
but not Denise Richards.
Yes.
And I was like, because I knew she was too young, but I was like, it can't. Like, I Googled her, and then, like, I Googled her again. I'm like, no, this can't be.
And she takes, I think this is the most baths per movie I've ever seen.
Oh, probably. But there's no nudity. Like, it's all, like, restrained, right?
It must be symbolic. Like, she just feels dirty being around that guy.
Amelia Heinle. H-E-I-N-L-E. When you Google her, like, the first autocomplete is Amanda Heinle, Denise Richards. It's like, it's everybody, like, because it's the same, she's the same person. And I thought, like, because she's beautiful, and I don't think she's a terrible actress, but I also have realized that I'm kinder to beautiful actresses for being bad actresses just because they're beautiful, which I guess is why they get in things. But she's only been in, like, 5 or 6 movies. I expect to see her in a lot more, but she hasn't been.
I felt like she was just more there to be like a point that this guy keeps trading in for younger women. And, you know, there's even a line that said, like, oh, I remember I suggested to your parents what to name you. I was like, Jesus.
Yeah, that's his first line. His first
yeah,
line.
Yeah, I was like, that is like super creepy territory right there.
Oh, I just realized why she's not in more things, because she's been in 1,400 episodes of The Young and the Restless.
Ah.
Okay, so she's a soap star.
So she's doing all right with herself.
Ah. Yeah, and I mean, that also goes to where I was going to go, is that I don't feel like everybody in this movie is there because they're great actors. Like, you take the warehouse dudes, like the fucko guy, like, you know, they give the least convincing high five after that line that I've ever seen in my life. But you just know, because they're not actors, that that's how it's going to play. And I think that's part of the point, is like, this is supposed to feel more populated like the real world. And in the real world, when people try to sound cool or keep their cool, they don't play it off very well, you know, even if they think they do. Not everybody's a great actor.
Yeah, it's ragged. It's shaggy. It's not. This is not a polished movie, which doesn't mean that it's not thought out or well considered. I mean, clearly it is, but there's a real, like, there's a run and gun quality to this, and like, and as you say, yeah, you want to get this to feel a little bit more like life in places. And I think that it sort of, the way he's mixing actors and non-actors, I sort of love that anyway. I'm a fan of that aesthetic, and I think it works. I think it works really well here.
Oh, I was gonna say, like, another couple characters that kind of fit in. Like, I think they're more actors than not actors, but there's a life to them and a specific type of casting that could be sort of in that same thing we're talking about. Is the hired killer and his sort of goon buddy,
Nicky Cat?
That guy looked like someone. Also, he looked like the guy from Justified,
Timothy Olyphant.
Yeah, I thought that one guy with the braids looked like Timothy Olyphant a couple of times I looked at him, but I guess it's not a clear resemblance if you did.
I mean, the best cop in any Cage movie from Gone in 60 Seconds.
Him and Delroy.
So we have them, and like, they have a really interesting, to say the least, introduction at the billiards table, and then they just, you know, get in that big bar fight there. And two other notes that I wrote down about them is that I thought it was really funny that this was 6 years before the TV show Extras would start, and they basically predict Extras.
Yep.
Did you guys catch that? They're like, yeah, like a TV show all about, like, the background actors. Like, oh, okay, like that's something, like that's just, I guess that was probably like an idea that a lot of people had and it just became real. But it was funny to see, like, I looked up when that show started to see if it predicted it, and it did. And then also the idea of them on the, like, the movie set, I guess, where they're like just like talking shit about everything that's going on is just so funny to me. I thought that was kind of, like, they're very colorful characters. Like, they feel more like characters than the rest of the real world around them in a way.
Yeah, and I feel like they're set up to be a real imposing threat, too, in a very short amount of time, and then they just kind of aren't. They aren't,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, they just, like, it, real world, the real life steps in, and these, like, DEA agents who have been tracking them step in before they could shoot our hero.
Which is so weird. It's such a weird detour, but, like, it works.
Yeah, it works. I mean, they're like red herrings or something, and I really love the way the film sort of dealt with that and said, like, no, like, once again, like, this isn't, we're going for a different type of death wish here. Like, in any other one, there'd be a big shootout and all these squibs and the cops would get shot and, like, someone would walk out of their apartment to see what was going on and they would get shot. Like, it would just be craziness, you know? And then instead in this, it's like, nope, 1, 2, 3, like, not even a shot fired. Or maybe one, but it's just like, yeah, it's just immediately swept under the rug.
Yeah, and Terrence Stamp's conversation with the head DEA agent is, for my money, one of the most fun scenes in the whole movie, where he comes in and, like, lays it all out for the guy and comes, you can see that he could put on another character, you know, that he's not, he says more in that scene than he probably says in the rest of the movie. It's just, I there's so much life in that. I think that's a great scene.
And that's Bill Duke as the head DEA.
Yeah.
Right? And he was, what did we just watch with him in it? Was that?
Oh, Henry's Crime for Keanu. Yep. Yeah, but I saw him at the, I went to the Predator double feature at the Draft House.
Yeah.
He's in Predator 1,
yeah.
So that was awesome.
But he also has the line of the movie, or one of the lines. I mean, there's so many good lines in this movie, but he's like, there's one thing I don't understand, that one thing is every motherfucking word you're saying. Because the whole movie, like, they keep setting up, like, he's using this, like, Cockney slang, and nobody knows what he's talking about. Like, everybody makes it very obvious that, like, we don't know what you're talking about. It doesn't matter. Like, it's because he is, like, an outsider. And again, you know, going back to the early Soderbergh movies, and most of what he's done, except for maybe Not Out of Sight, but they're all, like, you know, a protagonist that, or actually even Out of Sight, protagonist that sort of doesn't feel at home in the world around them, or, like, feels at odds with society. And here, once again, like, he's a very literal outsider, and people just don't know how to deal with him.
Yeah, and not only, it's crazy, like, he's a multi-tiered outsider. Like, not only is he not, he's, okay, so he's in America. He's originally, you know, from London. He's in America, so that's one. He just got out of prison, right? So, like, he's being reacclimated into society, so, like, that's two. And he's a career criminal, so that's kind of three, right? So, like, that with, like, his, the Cockney slang and the way he talks and his way of moving through the criminal underworld now and everything is, that's just, like, his education, like, what he knows. So I feel like he's got several strikes against him moving through this world. And I especially love that scene when he is sort of, when he's in front of the cops and he's just, like, verbal diarrhea. And because, like, he hasn't, I feel like he, you know, he's in front of an authority figure and he's going to revert back to, like, this 20-something-year-old crook. And he just can't help but try and impress this guy or talk his way out of something or anything. So I just think he's a really interesting character and in how he's able to function in this world, having been removed from it so much and so far for so long.
This will be an interesting yardstick to judge a lot of, or to examine a lot of his other movies going forward, because I think that looking at the list of movies we've watched so far, they all seem to have a protagonist who's dislocated in some way, except for maybe The Underneath.
Yep.
Which you can make an argument about, but he's coming home, and I don't know, the movie I like the least.
It's still sort of. Yeah.
But the movie I like the least seems to have the least to say about it. And all the other movies, you know, even Grey's Anatomy, very much a guy who's not comfortable in his skin or the world around him, that I think that sense of dislocation might be something that crops up in his better movies. We'll have to sort of pay attention to that, if I can give us an assignment.
Sure. No, yeah, look, that's something that, like, in these interviews that I have been reading with him, he keeps talking about, like, that's definitely a theme, that, like, that's what attracts him to scripts, is that protagonist sort of not comfortable in people around him. So I don't think that, like, I don't think you're going to become disinterested in that as a filmmaker as you go on. Like, I think, you know, if anything, you'll want to look for other ways to tell that kind of story, right? But, you know, I think that that's something that's always going to be, and again, like, you know, the movie I'm most familiar with of his, Ocean's 11, you sort of like, well, not really, but also still kind of, because he's like a criminal trying to fit in with the world and just sort of can't.
Yeah, that's why. Like, he's trying to, totally.
We also have a little bit of a preview down the line where Luis Guzman is wearing a Che Guevara shirt.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, that's cool. Career foreshadowing for Soderbergh. Like, I'm sure that for somebody to make a four-hour movie about Che, he was probably already interested in him at this time. So it sort of, you know, next, maybe a little nod or whatever there, but it was just cool to see that.
Did you catch the Access Hollywood footage of George Clooney?
That's exactly what I was just going to say, yep. That he's also got Clooney on TV. So it's like, not necessarily, like, it's not the same universe, but it's, you know, it's the Soderverse.
Well, I love how he just drops these Easter eggs in there, right? Clearly, I feel like that was sort of a dig at Clooney. Like, Clooney, who's, you know, known for being a practical joker on set and kind of getting under people's skin. I almost wonder if that was a practical joke that Soderbergh did for him, was to put that clip into one of his movies for everyone to see.
There's also one thing that I noticed, or I read in a previous trivia section that I didn't mention, but Soderbergh's company, or like production company or something, or whatever, is Perennial. And the word Perennial has been in three movies to date. It was in The Underneath and Out of Sight. And in this movie, the courier company that he visits is Perennial Couriers. And it also once again pop up in Traffic. So it's another little sort of Easter egg, not necessarily character related, but in four movies of his first 12-ish, by the time we get to Traffic, it's going to have, you know, a place or a person or a thing or whatever called Perennial, which is cool. Cool might be the wrong word.
Of note.
Of note.
One of my newer favorite directors, Adam Rifkin, who I discovered through Cage Club, he does sort of a similar thing where he has like the same signage in every one of his movies. It's not the name of his, I don't think it's the name of his production company, but it's like the face of his grandmother on the side. And it's just like the same company in every movie is represented.
At one point, Jenny, Terrence Stamp's daughter, says Daddy the Friendly Ghost, and I was like, this movie actually makes a lot of sense if you look at it as a ghost story.
Interesting.
I can see that.
I kind of want to, like, it's sort of a weird, I don't even know if it's an exercise, but like a weird thing to do, to like look at movies through a trope or through a type of movie, like a ghost story or like a monster movie or a slasher film or whatever, and sort of see if it hits those beats. Like, for instance, there was a movie that came out last year, but sort of became widely available this year, called The Love Witch, which is just this very hyper-pastel, you know, beautiful to look at, really slow-moving, weird movie where this woman falls in love with guys or has them fall in love with her, and then they all wind up dead. And so it's this weird movie, and it's hard to really understand what to make of it. But then if you look at it like it's a monster movie or like a slasher film or something, it kind of makes more sense, and you sort of have things to compare it against. Here, I mean, everybody is kind of haunted by Jenny. Like, she's not really in the movie. She's only in a couple flashbacks, a couple things in his head, but she's in every scene, and she's driving the whole thing, and she's, like, literally haunting
him. Well, that's funny. I was, when you said that, I was imagining the movie thinking about Terrence Stamp as a ghost. Like, maybe he doesn't exist. Maybe he's still in prison or has died there, and is, we are just seeing the ghost. The ghost doesn't know he's
or
right,
that,
he's,
yeah,
that he's a ghost. So he's just haunting and killing these people, or getting them to kill each other, or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, but I like that. I like that. That's, either way, that's an interesting way to sort of take a read on this movie.
Yeah, I definitely, well, you're saying that, I got the sense that Terrence Stamp could totally be like a Mike Myers or a Jason type character. I mean, he's just like this silver-haired guy in a black suit with a knife or a gun, and he just, you know, he's like unstoppable.
Well, if you think about the movie from Peter Fonda's point of view, it could feel like a ghost story or like a slasher where he's the impending victim. I mean, this movie from his point of view would definitely fit that model.
There's that great moment where his handler, or the guy looking after him, played by Barry Newman, is like, he said, tell him I'm coming. And he's like, who's coming? And he's like, nobody knows. And he's like, what the hell does that mean? He's like, I don't know, man, but he's like, I'm pretty sure we should be freaking scared right now. Yeah, but it's cool because he's like, I love how Fonda just has no clue as to like why his world is crashing down around him. Like, he's so self-absorbed. Like, I mean, probably in the back of his mind, he knows it's about Jenny, but he won't admit to himself until the very end that's what it's all about. So yeah, he's definitely haunted.
I don't think I have anything else, any other notes about this movie. Tobin, you have anything else you
want
to mention?
There are two MVPs that I want to call out in this movie. One is Leslie Ann Warren, who plays a sort of mentor friend to Jenny that Terrence Stamp goes to and learn and stays with at some point, I think, right? Do you think he's staying there? Anyway, she is an actress that I have loved since I was a very, very young child. She made and this is by no means her most famous movie, but she made a movie in 1982 called Victor Victoria that I used to watch way before I was old enough to know, that I should have been watching. It's a Blake Edwards comedy with Julie Andrews and Robert Preston, and I learned all kinds of things at a very young age from that movie that I should not have. But my grandmother loved it. We used to watch it in the summers over and over and over again. And in that movie, Leslie Ann Warren plays a character who's James Garner's mob boss girlfriend, and she's hysterical and has this funny voice. And so when I saw her crop up in this movie, because I just haven't seen her a lot, even though she works on TV a lot now, I guess. Anyway, she's wonderful, and I think she's great in this movie. And if you know movies from the 70s and 80s, she had a following, if you know those movies in that era and her at all, she resonates in the way that Fonda and Terrence Stamp do too. And the other person that we should mention that we haven't yet is Sarah Flack, who was the editor for the movie, who's done a lot of Sofia Coppola, in fact, all of Sofia Coppola's movies, and worked with other people as well. And I think that she is, and had worked, she had uncredited work on Schizopolis, apparently, and is going to work again with Soderbergh on Full Frontal before he decides to do all his own editing. But I think that she, even if she's just carrying out his vision, she's done enough other work that's quite interesting from an editing point of view. I always know I'm going to be in good hands in terms of the cutting when I see her name on a movie.
And she will be back for Full Frontal, too.
Well, my only other thing was to say, do you guys like this movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really like it. I mean, like I said earlier, I'm a fan of the genre, and for this to be so outside the box of that, it's not just Death Wish. There's lots of movies like this, but like none quite like this is what I'm trying to get at. So I love that it's able to take something so familiar and so basic and twist it in such a fresh and new way.
Not everybody likes this. People who I really respect and whose taste I admire, there's people who don't care for this. They either think it's too much, or that it's pretentious, or that it's too thin, that there's nothing there. And I've always gotten a lot out of this movie. Of the things we've seen so far, this is my second favorite after Out of Sight.
Really? Wow, I have it number four.
After Schizopolis and Sex Lies? I'm not partial on this. I've seen this probably too many times, and I admire the hell out of this movie. Of his movies, the two I wish I had made were The Limey and Out of Sight so far. So I have to put it up there.
Mike, any last thoughts about The Limey?
Just that I do like this movie a lot. I recommend this movie. Just a final note sort of about the way that it evokes the sort of 70s and 60s nostalgia through the actors and the mood and the feel. The guy I mentioned, Barry Newman, plays Peter Fonda's advisor or handler or money man, doing all like his sort of the bad guy that takes care of all the bad business. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but I sure as hell am, because he sort of did for cars what Peter Fonda did for motorcycles with a film called Vanishing Point.
Yes,
have you guys
familiar
with that? So that's him. And also this other one, Fear is the Key, which is another great car movie. And so it was really cool to see him actually get behind the wheel of a car in this and race down the street after them at one point and get into an accident and everything. So that was nice. I feel like that was almost an homage or something like that, a really cool thing to see him do in this movie. And there's all kinds of cool things going on in this, and I definitely recommend it.
Cool. Well, for all things Soderbergh and all of his movies, and the ones that we like better than this and the ones that we like less than this, and this is probably closer to the top, I think, for all of us than the bottom, so this is a good one to listen to and to watch. You can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter. See all the episodes that we've done, all the other shows in the network. Lots of fun, free things for you to listen to. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.